When non-citizens in the U.S. are convicted of a crime, they often go through two separate justice systems. One is a criminal court. Many of us know about that. The other is immigration court. That's where a judge can decide to have someone deported. In the Lumpkin, Georgia immigration court, nearly all of the cases that come into the courtroom result in deportations. That's according to an analysis from Syracuse University. NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickinson traveled to Lumpkin to meet a man who's awaiting his fate in immigration court. And Caitlin's report is part of NPR's Embedded podcast. She joins me from Washington, D.C. Hi, Caitlin. It's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Celeste. You too. Thanks for having me.
What is the concept behind embedded? What does that mean when you say a reporter is embedded?
Ah, okay. So for embedded, the sort of tagline that we use is that we take a story from the news and go deep. So we go somewhere that you've heard about in the headlines over the last year or so, and you sort of hear a bunch of stories out of that area at once, and then that's it. We want to kind of go there and sit there and hang out for a while and understand a more full picture. So earlier this year, you heard a lot about deportation raids that the Obama administration carried out as part of its immigration enforcement agenda. And I wanted to understand, okay, so people are being picked up at their homes, but then what happens next? And so that's why I went to embed in a Georgia immigration court.
And you focused on one person's story in particular. That's Sean. He came to the U.S. legally from Guyana when he was 10 years old. He and his wife and three kids live in and have lived in Georgia, but he was arrested in 2011. Tell me a little bit more about Sean and how he ended up in this court in Lumpkin.
Sure. So like you said, Sean's been in the U.S. since he was 10, since he was a kid. When he was in his 20s, he actually, he says he was a recreational pot smoker his whole life. That's how he describes it. And when he was in his 20s, he had two misdemeanor convictions for possession of pot. And those did not impact his immigration status until much later they came into play. What put him in court in Lumpkin was that in 2011, he was arrested with 4 ounces of marijuana. And he was charged with possession with intent to distribute. He also had digital scales and plastic baggies at home, evidence the police said suggested he was selling drugs. So he was convicted on that charge. He pled out and he served 17 months. But that criminal conviction, it violated his immigration status because he'd been a green card holder all his life. He was a legal permanent resident, but he didn't apply for citizenship. So that 2011 conviction, again, put him into immigration proceedings, and that's why he was in Lumpkin.
All right, so let's take a listen. And just a warning for listeners, this is official government audio. The sound quality isn't that great, but this is from the trial. And you hear government prosecutor Reed McKee bring up past criminal charges that did not lead to convictions.
Now, sir, looking at your arrest history, a person might draw the inference, since you've been arrested in 4 different states for possession with intent to distribute drug crimes, that you had been dealing drugs. Have you ever dealt drugs in the United States?
No, sir. I'm going to object to that question.
Now, the second voice we hear is Shah's defense attorney, Julio Moreno. Why is that? That is not something we would normally hear in a court most people visit. What's exceptional there?
Exactly. So throughout the story, there's sort of a theme of the differences between criminal and immigration law. And a big one is that in a criminal courtroom, there are a lot of actually rules about what sort of evidence you can introduce. And something like a past criminal charge that's going to make a defendant look really, really bad in front of either the judge or the jury, there's an extremely high bar to introduce something like that in criminal court because it's just a charge. It was never a conviction. But as I mentioned earlier, Sean had these earlier two misdemeanor convictions for possession of pot. In each case, he had initially been charged with intent to distribute, and those charges were dropped. Because the rules around evidence don't exist in immigration court, a government prosecutor can kind of bring up whatever they want. And so that this prosecutor in Sean's hearing chose to bring up those earlier charges as part of his bigger argument that Sean was a repeat offender, that he was a drug dealer, and that he should be deported.
And you also spoke for your story with Sean's attorney, Julio Moreno. Part of what you were talking about is that this difference in the standards of justice for a U.S. citizen versus someone who's an immigrant, et cetera, et cetera. And here's what he has to say.
I wish the system would change to safeguard people's rights. The way the system is set up now, they're set up to fail, and they don't really have a chance of winning a case or remain here in the U.S.
Now, Caitlin, I get that part of the purpose of doing an embedded report is to really see for yourself, right? To look behind the headlines and judge for yourself what mm-hmm. you see. Would you agree that in some ways the system is set up so that people fail?
I don't know that I would characterize it that way. You know, what I would say is that there are lots of things that are actually expressly called rights and protections that are given to people in the U.S. who are facing criminal charges, and they're not given to people who are facing immigration charges. And the other thing that I saw was that, you know, the reason for these differences, it has to do with a Supreme Court decision that was initially decided in the 1800s, and it's been upheld many times since then, that found basically the stakes just aren't as high as they are in criminal court, that when we deport someone, we're not punishing them. We're just sending them back to where they rightfully belong. That's the justification for these fundamental differences. And what I saw in Lumpkin was that, you know, for people like Sean, who is 40 years old, who's lived in the U.S. since he was 10 years old, has three U.S. citizen children, has a whole extended family here, and for people like asylum seekers who are fleeing violence in their home country, you know, I think the stakes are really as high as they come in immigration court. And so I think that's a good question to raise.
My guest is NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickerson. She recently visited an immigration court in Lumpkin, Georgia, to get a view of how it operates. This is part of NPR's Embedded podcast. And we did reach out to the U.S. Department of Justice for a comment. Its Executive Office for Immigration Review oversees immigration courts, and a spokesman says the department does not comment on immigration judge decisions or third-party reports on immigration proceedings. We reached out to the Georgia Department of Corrections as well and did not get a response. Caitlin, part of your reporting is this particular court in Lumpkin, and I assume the reason that you were there is the high percentage of people who get deported. Now, I looked at the ICE standards, and they said that actually, at this point, it's 50% or fewer cases that come before an immigration court end up in deportation. Did you get any insight into why Lumpkin's percentage is so much higher?
I did, yeah. So there are a few reasons. One is that Lumpkin is in the 11th Federal Circuit, so immigration court decisions are dictated by precedent, by what other federal courts in the region have decided on whatever is at issue. And Georgia is in, you may or may not know, one of the toughest federal circuits in the country on immigration. So in other words, judges in Lumpkin have guidance that is tougher than it is, say, in California or in New York. That's one reason. Another is that in Lumpkin, all of the immigrants who are being tried are in custody. They're detained. So that typically means that, you know, it's more likely that they have a criminal history, which is why they may or may not have been able to get out on a bond. So there are other immigration courts where they're seeing both people who are in custody and those who aren't. In Lumpkin, you're more likely to have a criminal record, and so that can be another reason. And so that probably accounts for some of the big difference. You know, 97.7% of people are deported in Lumpkin. But there's also a big element of discretion in immigration court decisions. And so it's really hard to tell whether those two things I just mentioned account for the entire difference, or if there's some difference in discretion as well that factors in.
And I should mention that ICE stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yes.
We spoke with Azadeh Shashahani. She's the legal and advocacy director with the Atlanta-based group Project South. And she used to oversee the National Lawyers Guild and worked with Georgia's ACLU. She says that this data that came from Syracuse University actually is concerning about our state.
Georgia generally has a very high deportation rate for a non-border state. Texas is number one, California is number two, and Georgia is number three, which, you know, really should raise eyebrows for a non-border state. Why do we have such high deportation numbers?
I think part of what makes your report a kind of eye-opening is that while you're embedded, it really does kind of take us behind the impact of some of these decisions. I mean, you'll read these percentages and the number of removals, and the number of deportations has actually fallen since a high in 2012. But then you get these scenes like this. This is Julio Moreno talking to Sean's family after it was decided. The judge said that Sean was going to be deported.
And hopefully we have a better judge to review the whole case. Everybody's conceding that he has been convicted.
Yeah, of course.
But the whole point of his defense is that he's changed and he's ready to make
a
full change in his life. So,
Judge,
judge is heartless. You know, all we're saying that give him another chance. Give him a chance.
What is he going to do again?
That
what
Sean
is she going to do there? I
would have changed. He changed.
Where does Sean's case stand now?
Sean appealed to the immigration courts after that day, and he lost his appeal just recently. So he's sitting right now in detention, and he'll be deported to Guyana any day. So his family, who you heard in that clip, is just kind of trying to figure out what's next.
What did you learn? I mean, you're a journalist, and you've been a journalist for quite some time, which means you've done a lot of reporting on immigration. But what did you learn that perhaps surprised you?
I think the discretionary piece of immigration court decisions was probably one of the most interesting takeaways for me, which is that, you know, in a criminal court, there's a legal question at issue, and you've got to present evidence, and you've got to help either convince a judge or a jury that you've made a strong enough case. And that's true in immigration court. But then there's this second higher test that can be really hard to figure out. So in that clip, right before the family starts crying, Julio's explaining to the family, you know, we had all this evidence. We tried to convince the judge that Sean was a good guy, that he'd rehabilitated himself. We thought we had enough, but clearly we were wrong. And that's because ultimately it really is a subjective decision at the hands of the judge. And as I said before, there's just so much at stake for people like Sean and his family.
That is NPR investigative reporter Caitlin Dickerson. To hear all of her coverage about the immigration court in Lumpkin, Georgia, you can visit gpbnews.org. We have a link there to NPR's embedded podcast. Caitlin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.